looking at the rectal lining cells first. The rectal lining cells are composed of a layer of columnar epithelium, okay? So those are those kind of box-like cells just in the middle of that diagram. And this is really why we think that the rectum is so prone to potential incident HIV infection. It's one cell layer thick. But if you look under that cell layer, then there's a whole load of cells which are receptive to HIV infection. The anal canal, by contrast, is entirely different. So if you go further south, we look at the anal canal, and essentially the anal canal is made up of moist skin cells. So there's about 15 to 20 layers of skin cells, and you think, well, that's a great thing to happen. So, you know, really vulnerable on the left-hand side, probably not so vulnerable on the right-hand side. However, the anal canal is surrounded by this huge, big area of muscle called the anal sphincter. You can see those, and it's kind of a pink colour behind that bottom arrow. So there's two sphincters there. There's an external sphincter, which we can all clench at will, and I'd like you to do that now. And there's also the internal sphincter, which we're really glad is there because it maintains continence even when we're not thinking about it. Okay. So that's a difference in the lining cells. And I'll come back a little bit more to the rectal lining cells when we talk about microsomes. We're now, much more interestingly, talking about anal and rectal sensation, as it is sensational. The rectum, however, is not particularly sensational because it responds in, you get awareness of the rectum just in three ways. Distension, obviously pleasure, but then if there's too much distension, then suddenly the pain receptors trigger and you experience pain. The anal canal is entirely different. So the anal canal has every single sensation you can think about. Essentially, the way the anal canal forms when you're an embryo is there's no initial anal canal. It just kind of pops in from some skin cells, and it takes all those skin receptors with it. So you're aware of hot and cold and wet and dry, light touch, pinprick, distension, again pleasure, and also pain. So if you're thinking about what's going on with your anal canal, That's where you're going to feel it. So essentially in the rectum you may not feel very much. In the anal canal you're going to know all about it, particularly as it works its way towards the outside. Now, this is just a clinical picture. So if I was looking up into an anus, then I would see the anus, which is around the outside. There. So it's kind of shiny, pearly pink. And then you see a line here, which is the transition zone between the anal canal and the rectum, and then the rectum in the middle, okay? So I mentioned the anal sphincter, but just to give you an idea of what it can generate, resting pressure, internal anal sphincter that we're not under control of, resting pressure is about 17 millimeters of mercury. If we really put our minds to it, we can ramp that up to 180 millimeters of mercury. Now, just think of when you go and see the clinician, go and see your doctor, someone's taking your blood pressure, when it gets really uncomfortable, when the guy's pumping that bulb up, that's about 180 millimeters of mercury, okay? So it's incredibly tight, and it's because of that tightness, or potential tightness, particularly with anxiety or stress or uncertainty, that can lead to anal trauma. And this is the kind of trauma I'm talking about. So all of these conditions, with a fissure on the left-hand side, you can see, I don't know why it's yellow, you can see the anal margin there, and that is a huge, big, almost a split in the anal verge. You can just imagine how painful it is. And then on the right-hand side, simply trauma from anal sex. So it's an area which is, because of the pressure of the sphincter, it's vulnerable to almost cuts, if you like. And if you have cuts, then guess what? You're exposing that area to semen and potentially, again, incident HIV infection. Right. Let's go on to sexually transmitted infection. I've got a selection of STDs here, STIs. First of all, herpes simplex. Incredibly common, usually herpes simplex type 2 genitally. And although it's often asymptomatic, so it's something which happens which you're not really aware of, if herpes is going to be symptomatic, it tends to cause ulceration around the anus. Primary infection will tend to involve the rectum. Recurrent infection will most likely be noticed around the anal canal. Ulceration, pain, discomfort. Just to give you a vision of what that is, you can see quite a large ulcer there. That area there. Again, exposing all these cells which could potentially get infected with HIV. From painful to painless, and that's syphilis. So primary syphilis is almost never noticed in the anal canal. And this is why, because you know, you'd have to be pretty forensic if you were, well, first of all, you couldn't see that yourself unless you worked for the circus. Very few people, when they're going to have anal sex, are looking at this amount of detail at the anal canal and just kind of surveying the area, checking there's no primary syphilis there. It's never seen. So generally, people present with secondary syphilis if the primary infection is in the anal rectum. Right, let's move on to chlamydia and gonorrhea. They infect the rectum. And we've talked before about the fact that the rectum really doesn't have much sensation. So most of the time, these infections are completely without symptoms. 90% of the time, they're completely without symptoms. Which is surprising because, you know, if I'm doing an anal clinic and I put a scope in, I can sometimes see this, which is some goopy discharge there, and then really a pretty inflamed and angry looking rectum. But that's not always the case. That's really, really unusual. Most of the time, I'm surprised when I take the swab and it comes back positive because it looks absolutely normal. Okay? Then moving on to human papillomavirus. And most often, people of course get worried about anal warts, internal anal warts, external anal warts. Anal warts are essentially they're almost like the good players because they are caused by a lower risk HPV infection and are not going to turn into cancer. However, just a little bit more on anal HPV. Almost everyone here has anal HPV. If you have sex, you essentially have been exposed to HPV. It doesn't really matter what kind of sex you're having, HPV will tend to find its way there, which is always a surprise for straight men. If you look at who has HPV infection, actually detectable infection, and take a swab, detect HPV, then HIV positive men and sex with men and women lead this with about 90, it's almost ubiquitous, it's 93%. Then HIV uninfected men have sex with men, then uninfected women and uninfected men down at water. So it's incredibly common. So even if you don't detect it, it may have been there and it's simply been controlled and it's undetectable. But the bottom line is, almost everyone has it. These are the types I was talking about, so really differentiating low risk from high risk. Low risk HPV causes low grade dysplasia, which is a word for cell abnormality, and also genital wart. High risk HPV can of course cause low grade, but it can also cause high grade dysplasia, so a precancerous change in the anal canal, and is associated with anogenital cancers. And that's important because HIV infected men who have sex with men are at high risk of developing anal cancer. You can see the figures here. General population, 2 per 100,000. Female predominance tends to be women in their 60s. However, in the early 80s, there was a study which showed that men who had sex with men, pre-HIV if you like, also had an increased risk of anal cancer. But that's nothing compared to the risk of HIV-infected men. That's really important to take home. What can we do? Well, actually, we can do exactly the same as we do for women. So we can take pap smears of the anal canal. We can also look at the anal canal for those precancerous areas and get rid of them, often with very easily tolerated things to do to the anal canal, such as putting a bit of acid in there. Sounds horrific. absolutely painless, because most of the changes happen at the very top of the anal canal, where there's where all of these those sensory nerve endings kind of fade out. Okay. Right. I'm talking about Australia now because they are the poster children of HPV vaccination. So the Australians, in their wisdom, gave HPV vaccination to all Australian women. And when they did that, the women said, fantastic, let's all get vaccinated. And that's the vaccination coverage. It's about between 70 and 80%. Compare and contrast the US, which is currently 30. And look what happened. The from 2007, which is there, when vaccination started, this is looking at genital wart diagnoses. And this is what was happening with genital warts in Australian women and men. Before vaccination, boom, down 75% following vaccination. So warts are great to look at because warts happen after about maybe 6 to 8 weeks after exposure. But we can also extrapolate thinking, well, you know, if warts are decreased, then HPV is decreased, and so dysplasia may be decreased. And in 50 years' time, there'll be a huge impact on the amount of anal cancer diagnosed in Australia. Right, let's get on to lube, because everyone loves lube. This is just a selection of everyone's favorite lubricants. But it's not always benign. It may be fun, but it's not always benign. So what this shows here is a little bit of rectum looked at under the microscope. So remember, these cells up here are those same kind of column-like cells that I pointed out in the first diagram. So concentrate on those ones. Rectal lining cells there, and then underneath, that's where all the cells receptive to it, which could be receptive to HIV. That's all normal. If we put in something which is isosmolar, meaning that the gel is, you know, the same concentration, if you like, as rectal secretions or blood or tissue, then absolutely nothing changes. Those cells are still there. Ignore that glob of goop there. Just the cells are absolutely the same. However, if you put in hyperosmolar gel, like a concentrated gel like Astroglide, for example, or even KY, there's absolutely no epithelium left. There's no lining cells left. It's all sloughed off. Probably due to a fluid shift. So fluid is sucked from the rectum through that epithelium, completely takes the epithelium off, and you're left with exposed subepithelial cells. I mean, what could happen there? So let's have a look at lubes. This is really what I was talking about. So semen, about 300, but then look at Astroglide, 6,000 in terms of concentration units. So look at your favorite lubricant and just check what's going on. Pre is a lubricant that we tend to use in our studies because we know it's not going to mess things up. So that's maybe something to think about. Right, just very, very briefly, going on to the risk of HIV power exposure. Of course, everyone in this room knows that receptive element, of course, is the highest risk for incident HIV infection. We've talked about lubes. We've talked about receptive anal sex. Wouldn't it be great if we had a lubricant or a product which was like a gel or a lubricant that we could put into the rectum to protect against HIV infection? Well, hey presto, that's what we've been working on. Jonathan talked about the microbicide trial network. This is a study called MTN-017. And both Jonathan and Alex, myself, have been working very hard for the last few years, with Claire as well, trying to get this baby finished, and it's finally finished. So this is what we did. We have found out that if we put an antiretroviral into a lubricant and we very carefully look at how both men and women respond to that, we found that this formulation of tenofovir was acceptable. So it was used in an applicator, okay? Obviously not a particularly sexy applicator, but we had to make sure we were getting the right amount of lubricant in the right place at the right time. This was a study which was an extended safety and acceptability study. So 186 men, sex of men and trans women across the globe, US, Peru, Thailand and South Africa, came into a study and they And a randomized way had three different regimes. They had rectal gel daily for 8 weeks. They had rectal gel both before and after receptive anal sex. And they also had oral Truvada prep. And so we've just stopped the study. The results are probably, hopefully, going to be presented in February in Boston, we hope. So that's what to look out for. So Boston, February, conference, retrovirus conference, hopefully this will be kind of presented to the world. And then we could perhaps look forward to what may be an effectiveness study to see if actually this does work in its user actually. So back to populations who generally have anal sex. Anal sex is associated with fissuring, fistulas, abscesses, ulceration, and sexually transmitted infection. Just to kind of emphasize the bad points of anal sex. There's lots of good points, but I'm here as a clinician to talk about the bad stuff. So please, get your ass checked. And with that, I just want to thank you, and I'll pass the mic on to Alex. Yes, exactly. Silicone is the way forward. Or one of those water-based loops, which is the same osmolality like pre. But they're kind of it's called pre-seed, because it's used in particularly for heterosexual couples who have problems conceiving. So that's been a consideration for, you know, the osmolality, the concentration has been a consideration for that population. So, you know, trying to do things which are as physiological as possible in that context.
Right, and I think it's important because as community-based organizations, we give out ID Glad all the time.
Right.
So we.
The one thing I would say about that is, some loop is better than no loop, because no loop means anal trauma and you know, probably pain and potentially ulceration trauma. So loop is better than no loop, but trying to get that message across about the selectivity of lubricants is probably quite important.
One more question. Okay, right here, blue button up. You said that
so what I'm saying is that most people who have any kind of sex will acquire types, anogenital types of HPV. And then there's a few things that can happen. For the most part, HPV just sits there and does absolutely nothing. Your body controls it. But in some people who for somehow just, you know, their DNA just doesn't kind of jive particularly well with the HPV infection, then warts can appear. Or you can, with the higher risk HPVs, you can develop cell abnormalities that over time, in some people, may develop into pre-cancer and even cancer. Unfortunately, we can't tell yet who that person could be, but if HPV is there, then it's a possible sequel of that happening.
We're gonna let Dr. Diego Alex, go. If you have additional questions, we'll have time at the end.
Thank you. There are some seats in front here if you guys want to come. There are some seats in the middle of the room in the lobby. You have three more seats there and some back there. Okay, so we're switching from a Scottish accent to another kind of accent. Can you tell? I am a behavioral scientist, so what I will be talking about has to do more with behavior than what Dr. Cranston discussed, which has to do with medical aspects of anal health. I will focus on behaviors that happen around anal sex that may have implications for anal health. So, anal health has been documented since ancient times. This is a cup that is called the Warren Cup, because that was the owner of the cup. It's currently in the British Museum, and it shows on the left a man holding himself from a strap and sitting on someone's penis. I guess you could call that an active bottom, right? On the right, you have two men also having anal sex. And what is interesting is that you can see other artifacts in in different cultures that show anal sex, not always in a same gender context, but sometimes also in a heterosexual situation. Probably in this case, there's an issue of avoiding pregnancy because, you know, there's a kid under the blanket. But this goes to show that anal sex is not an unusual behavior or something modern, right? Now, coming to the present, why is anal health perpetuated? Well, most likely because there are many issues around anal sex beyond pregnancy prevention that have to do with pleasure, that are important for many of us, and that make it a regular behavior. We have been studying people in who engage in bareback sex, and we have defined bareback as sex without condoms in contexts in which there can be a risk of HIV transmission, and that is intentionally condomless. And by that we mean it's not a couple that is monogamous and is not using condoms. These are folks who are having many partners and who know that condoms could prevent HIV transmission, yet they don't use them. And when we discuss with them the reasons leading to this, to no one's surprise, pleasure was one of the main reasons that was making them forego condom use. So we started thinking, what are the elements that could be bring into thinking about this issue that would not conflict with pleasure, but that could be aligned towards preventing HIV transmission. And so we thought about douching, lubricant use, use of sexual toys and other sexual practices, and trying to think what happens there, how it can increase the risk of transmission, and how it could potentially be used to decrease risk of transmission. So starting with douching, like 20 years ago, we started to do studies asking men with what frequently they douched, how many they douched, and so forth. And there have been many or some other studies that have been taking place since then, which I'm happy about because they are bringing more attention to this issue. It's very difficult to say how many men douche. And by douche, I mean some people may just call it enemas, but there are different language around this. I think that when you look at vaginal products, women generally refer to vaginal douches, not vaginal enemas, right? And there's something that is more French about calling it douche. Although, I also know there are douche bags, but that's another story. So it's difficult to say with what frequency people douche, because it's difficult to get a representative sample of the population to explore that. There have been some studies that have large numbers of people. The first one had almost 5,000 people. These are studies conducted generally as part of separate studies that were not designed to assess frequency of douching. There's another study that was international, both men and women participated, and it was undertaken by the International Rectal Microbicides Association, IRMA. What they tell us, more or less, take it with a grain of salt, is that 52% of the people interviewed say that they have at one point douched. Those who do it say that they have done it recently, like 77% or 62%, you know, the percentages vary, but have done it recently. of those who do it, they tend to have a lot of frequency of douching, and they do it mostly before in an intercourse. Some do it after, and some do it both times. But most of the case is that people douche before in an intercourse to cleanse themselves, to feel more comfortable, to feel prepared for the sexual act. We had a small study with barebackers in New York, and in that case also we found that about 51% douched recently, and they also did it before sex. Now, what do people use to deliver a douche? Here are some of the devices. They can use something that comes already prepared, and they buy it in the store. They can use balls. This is called a sinker. It's something that can be attached to a the faucet in a sink and has a hose and some different devices to put at the end. There's something that can be attached to the shower, or there are some portable bags, neoprene bags that use gravity to deliver the product. In terms of the product that is delivered, most people tend to use water, but sometimes water is combined with soap or salt or some other products. And a third of the people tend to use commercially prepared douches. Laxatives per se are not that that popular, but there are different kinds of douches that people use. Now, the problem, as Dr. Cranston said before, is that some of these products may be associated with problems, with health problems. Many of the studies show an association, which doesn't mean causality. That means when they check how many people who douche also have anal pathologies or HIV or hepatitis B or C, they find that people who douche may have more frequency of these pathologies. But it's difficult to precise that it was the douching that led to them, although there is some evidence from looking at the tissue that it may affect it. But there may be other issues that generally you try to sort out. What was it, the number of partners? What was it, whether the partners were circumcised or not? I mean, there are many other things that come into play, but we have to be careful about that. Also, as Ross said before, formulation matters. There are certain products that are more likely to produce an effect on the mucosa, and others that are likely to be more helpful. Thank goodness, help is on the way. There are studies currently ongoing on how to develop an enema. I couldn't fight them to get them to put douche there instead of enema, but okay. This is a study being done by Craig Hendricks and his group. He's at Johns Hopkins University, and the project is called DREAM, Developing a Rectal Enema as an Acrobicide. And the idea is to use a douche as a vehicle to deliver an ingredient in the mucosa that could protect against HIV. And hopefully what this group is trying to do is to develop something that could last for maybe up to a week. Meaning that if you douched on Friday in preparation for the weekend, well, you may be covered for several days. You will need to keep reapplying the product. It's a study that is long and complicated. It starts with laboratory work, it goes to animal work, and that's going to be before the clinical trials, so it's on its way. The second topic I wanted to talk about, it's only four, bear with me, has to do with anal lubricants. And again, they are frequently used. We've been asking about this for a number of years, and there's more work that has happened since. Again, it's difficult to say how frequently people use lubricants. And this slide gives you some of the research that is available, sometimes with bigger or smaller samples. The issue is that it's not that the world is divided between lubricant users and non-lubricant users. Sometimes people use lubricants according to contextual issues. I always remember a participant who said, well, I always use lubricants, and unless the penis is too small, in which case I don't use lubricants because I want to feed it, right? So there are issues that may vary the the amount of lubricant that is used, and if it is used at all. And of course, many people use just saliva. But the topic is interesting because it could, again, be used, as we have heard before, in terms of a vehicle for the delivery of a microbicide. Lubricants are generally applied with the fingers around the anus or on the penis. There are some toys that are sold that are also used for application, but I think they're less frequently used. There are water-based, silicone-based, and oil-based products, and as we heard before, how's that, Crisco? have I just shown my age by showing Crisco there? Okay, I won't put that up anymore in this slide. But what's important is that they may have different effects, and we've been told forever that we should use water-based lubricants, but you know, all of these requires probably further research. You all remember that at one point people thought that nonoxidil 9, which is the detergent that is a part or was part of many vaginal products, could be used to counteract HIV infection or to prevent it. And so in the 80s, in the gay community, there was a lot of emphasis in terms of saying, well, try to get lubricants with N9. It was shown that it was all the opposite, that N9 as a detergent affected the cells and that it was probably favoring HIV transmission. So that's why it is important to understand how these lubricants may work. And again, in this area, there are currently studies going on that are showing which are the lubricants that can be more benign. And Charlene DeLucy, who works in, is a colleague of Ross in, you know, at Pittsburgh University, has been working to determine which lubricants are safer. The Population Council also conducted some studies using Caraguard, which is derived from an algae that is used in food and things like that, and it also showed not to have any negative effects. Now, there are sexual toys, you may have seen them in erotic stores, that are used inserting them in the rectum. And there are other practices, like fingering, fisting, analingus, that means putting the tongue in the rectum, in the anus, and the introduction of foreign objects. The picture is not an endorsement by the presenter of the rumors that circulate about the actor and the gerbil, but it's just a decoration for the slide. So how frequently these practices are? It's again, we have a little research on that, but on a large study with about 20,000 Australian men and women, they reported that 12% of the men and 14% of the women had used sex toys, and 17% of the men and 14% of the women have engaged in anal stimulation with fingers. Fisting was not a very widespread behavior, it's less than 1%, and 5% of the men and 3% of the women have engaged in analingus, meaning the tongue in the rectum. I suspect that these percentages are too small for reality. There are behaviors that are hard to accept, particularly an interviewer, to say, yes, that's something I do, and so often we get under-reporting and things like that. There are some problems related to some of these practices. Sometimes they have been shown to result in apparently in a transmission route for genital or anal warts, or have been associated with hepatitis C infection. Fisting may lead to mucosal damage or to physical trauma, and these are all the reasons why we need to better understand the behaviors and to see how to make them less problematic. One lesson that we have learned with douching in women is that if you tell them, you know, these douches are bad for you, but the women feel more comfortable, fresh, clean, and appealing to the partner, they will still use it. So it's not a matter of saying don't use it, it's a matter of coming up with a product that can accomplish the goals of using it, but not be problematic. And that's where we have to put our work. On this topic of toys and other practice, I don't know if there's any research going on, but probably given that this is an advocacy conference, we have to think how to stimulate that work. Finally, I know we have been talking about MSM, but anal sex happens in women. It's not something that is completely unusual. There have been studies that show that young women, 20 to 49, 40% of them report that they have had anal sex. People who are older, and maybe this is a generation thing, that they report a fewer, less proportion of people who have had anal sex. But that's why many of the studies that we conduct try to assess, for example, the safety of a product both in men and in women, with the hope that the agenda on protection, rectal protection, will expand beyond MSM. So that's all for now. Thank you.
We have time for just one clarifying question as Mitchell gets ready to present. Is there anyone who has a question? Back here in the back.
Yes, on one of your slides it said that fisting has been associated with hepatitis C infection, and I was just wondering if you could care to elaborate on that a little bit more.
No, I put the reference because the slides are going to be shared, and so you can see exactly where to look for it. But I cannot really give you the details about what may be happening. Ross, do you know?
So a lot of the first information on this came from, I think it was the Amsterdam cohort, and that the context of hepatitis C infection tended to be fisting parties. And so if there's going to be fisting, there's generally a bit of blood. And so it was probably more a blood-borne infection on the fister's hand.
Thank you.
Coconut oil? People put funny things in as lubricants, and that's part of the problem, how to really have a careful study to detect whether that is better or less, or, you know, problematic compared to something else.
All right, good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
So I do not have an accent, but I can try. And I also realize that it's hot in here, so I'm going to talk pretty fast and kind of get to the question and answer period. But I'm going to be talking about Black MSM and anal health care. So my objectives are to talk about what does anal health mean to Black MSM, to identify some barriers to seeking anal health care, to address some stigma issues, and reaching communities in need. How do we do that? And now you've had two presentations that were very heavy on scientific work. Mine is going to be a little bit different. So I'm going to tell you in the context of three stories of three patients or three people that I've interacted with. What I want you to do is really listen closely to the story so that you can hear exactly what some of those barriers are that they're facing, how we move through those, how we find resolution, and how we build communities as we go along through the process. Okay. Before I go to the next slide, Ross did a phenomenal job of describing the anus, the rectum. I learned some things I hadn't known before, despite having some advanced medical knowledge. How many people here, just as a quick raise your hands, how many people knew all that stuff? Okay, looks like you're the only one. All right. And so I raised that question to say, you know, how is it that we really learn about our bodies? How is it that we learn about our anus? How does we learn about anal health? For most people, it's something that we gloss over in our school textbooks, or we learn about it from our family members, maybe a mother or an aunt who's kind of really concerned about things. My mother was a nurse, so she asked every single question possible if there was something wrong with the anus. But a lot of times we learn from our friends, and sometimes it goes a little bit like this.
Oh.
the booty out.
Sound familiar to anyone? And sometimes that truly is the extent of what we get to know. I didn't expect that much of a response. So when we talk about anal health, we ask, what does anal health mean to Black MSM? Now here, we're in the context of an HIV conference, so clearly anal health is related to sex and sexuality. But let's take a step back and let's think about other things that it could possibly mean and that it should possibly mean. So it should mean evacuating your bowels regularly. It should mean exercising. It should mean having a good diet. And although it's not related to HIV, nor is it really truly related to anal health, really focusing on having your prostate checked. So because of its close proximity to the rectum. So those are some other things that we really need to start thinking about in terms of anal health. We cannot just collapse the conversation and just have it just on HIV. But I'm going to tell you a couple of stories now. So I've got three people that I've interacted with. So the first person is Carmen. And let me tell you, I love me some Carmen. Carmen is awesome. So Carmen is 18 years old. She works 2 to 3 jobs, including working at an adult video store. He lives with his parents. He identifies as genderqueer. And in such, he is always late for the gods. Eyebrow snatched, face beat, thick thighs, and loving. Okay. Always put together, a little bit of sass, but also enough street smarts to say if you cross him, he's gonna cut you. He identifies as genderqueer, as I said. He exclusively has sex with men, and his anal sex practices are that he's both receptive and he's an insertive partner. So I first met Carmen as a participant in one of my research studies. So I was looking to find ways, looking to identify how young Black men who sex with men believe that they keep themselves HIV negative. And so we talk about a lot of things in the study, in the interview. We talk about their history growing up. We talk about their identities of masculinity and femininity. We talk about their first sexual practices. So we get to start talking about sex. And this is a part of the interview that everybody loves. So he starts off and says, I guess I've always been fascinated with sex, you know? It's like a big part of who I am. It's just one of those things that I do, I live, I breathe it, I work at the adult bookstore, I know all the porn stars by name, and I can tell you this, that, I can tell you how big they are, every position that you can think of. And so as I'm going through this, I'm like, wow, you're really excited about this, you really like this. So, you know, let's start talking about your sexual habits. And so he said, well, you know, I like sex, you know, I do it both ways. I'm like, okay. Well, when was the first time that you had sex? All of his excitement, all of his enthusiasm dropped immediately. So I said, well, what is this about? And we kind of faltered around and moved around. He evaded the question for quite a while. Until at some point, he just got really frustrated. He said, you know what? Fine, I'll tell you. So when I was 5 years old, I was abused by my cousin, and then the babysitter abused me, and then I got put in a mental health home, and then I was abused there. And this was all in one breath. I was like, wow. That's a lot of stuff. And so he said, yeah, well, I really don't like to talk about it, you know, because you know, it's something I try to put behind me. We went through and kept talking about just in terms of his general sexual habits, his general sexual behaviors. And so I asked him, I said, you know, well, you talked about this history of being sexually abused and sexually traumatized as a child. You know, who did you talk to? Who did you go to for help? He's like, well, I tried to talk to my mom. She really didn't want to hear it, she didn't listen to me, so I really didn't have anybody to talk to. In fact, this is the first time that I've mentioned it to anyone. I said, wow, that's incredible. We continued on with the conversation for a little bit, and I asked him about, you know, his recent partners, and he said, yeah, I have sex with people, but when I have anal sex, you know, I always get myself cleaned out, you know, I won't tell you what he did, because the next one, I'll tell you about what he does. But he says, I always get myself cleaned out, get myself ready. And then, you know, I get nervous when I do it. I said, well, why is that? Is that because of the trauma that happened before? He's like, yeah, I think that's part of it. But when I do sleep with men and they do top me, what I do is I make sure that I'm in my house and, you know, I'm laying down and underneath my pillow, I have a knife.
Oh.
Yeah. So So he's got like a huge knife that he has there. And he says, if a person talks to me, if a person won't get off of me, if they don't stop what I don't like, then I pull the knife out on them. Okay? So I know that it's not specific to just anal health, but we have to look at the other confounding factors that happens in a person's life when we're talking about anal health and their readiness to go to a provider if they have an issue or just for general health purposes. This young man clearly is suffering some post-traumatic stress syndrome, and it's not something that we talk about very often. So that's Carmen. I will say one more thing about Carmen. So a couple of weeks after I interviewed Carmen, she did have an HIV scare. And I use she and he interchangeably because that's how he identifies. One day maybe she, one day maybe he. She called me and said, hey, I have an HIV scare. I'm really concerned. Will you go to the doctor's office with me? And I said, absolutely, not a problem whatsoever. And so as we're driving there, as we're talking, I'm telling her what to expect, because it's not just HIV, we do comprehensive testing in Rochester. And so I gave her the full lowdown of what to expect in terms of what's gonna happen when you get in with the provider, how they're gonna do things, what they're gonna do, what they're gonna take samples of. And it was very reassuring for her, and it was kind of a pep talk to prep her up for what was about to happen, because she had no clue. And just as a side note, she was HIV negative and did not have any STIs at that point. The next person is Omar. Omar is a great guy. So Omar is 32 years old. He's a high school teacher at a private school. So he's got wonderful insurance. He also shares an apartment with a roommate. Now he identifies as bisexual. He's had sex with men more than women. And in fact, his current partners have all been men. In terms of his anal activity, he's receptive only. So I first met Omar as I was doing a health talk at one of our local LGBT organizations. Oddly enough, it was on anal health. So as we're sitting there, as we're talking, he's very interested in the conversation. He asked me for my business card, and so I gave it to him. A couple of weeks later, I get a telephone call from him saying, hey Mitchell, can I talk to you about something? I have a situation that needs some medical advice. Now, why would someone who has great medical insurance, who's well-educated, give me a call about something for medical advice? Turns out the situation is that he was bleeding rectally. He's a very fit guy, very active guy. So every time that he went to the gym and every time he did squats, he would notice that there was some blood in his shorts. I said, that's interesting. You know, it might be hemorrhoids, might be something else. We don't know exactly what it is. He proceeds to tell me that he has been having anal receptive sex, and that the lubrication that he's using, I don't remember what it was, but in terms of preparation for it, he douches. And I don't mean he uses an enema. I mean, he actually went and bought a feminine hygiene product, and that's what he uses on a regular basis. Now, this is a well-educated person who's teaching young students. He's got great health insurance. Somebody along the way should have said, hey, this isn't what you need to do. This isn't where you should be doing. This isn't how you should be doing it. But he didn't have that context. Just as a quick side note to him, most of his partners were actually white or Asian. So he did not date black men at all. So when it comes to talking about sexual health practices, when it comes to talking about being a black MSM, he really didn't have the context of a black MSM community. So my recommendation to him was, okay, so let's talk about what's going on with you. I did an evaluation over the telephone, but it was critical for me to find him a healthcare provider that he could trust. And that was a big thing for him. He did not want all of his business out in the street, people knowing that he's anally receptive, people knowing that he has sex with men, particularly in the area that he was. It was a very affluent area. So we struggled to find a primary care provider that would really take care of him very well. Turns out that we didn't have to find a primary care provider. We actually sent them to our STD clinic. Fortunately, at the time, I had a very good colleague who was working there at the STD clinic, and I called him up on the phone. I said, listen, I've got somebody that I need you to see. I don't want him to wait in the waiting room. I don't want him to see anybody else. I want you to see him as soon as he walks in the door. He said, great, no problem. I'll see him as soon as he comes in. Went over, checked in, not more than 2 seconds after he got there, the receptionist went back, got my friend, the clinician, and he brought him back, and we got everything straightened out for him. But again, it's education, and it's finding somebody who's actually trustworthy. All right, last one, Carl. Carl is my old school gentleman. He's a Southern gentleman. He's 67 years old.
Yeah.
He has recently retired as an engineer. He lives with his partner of 18 years. So he identifies as same gender loving. Notice I did not say gay. I did not say bisexual. It is same gender loving. That is how he defines himself. And he only has sex with men. In terms of his anal sex practices, he's only insertive. He's only the insertive partner. When I first met this gentleman in my clinical practice, the situation was is that he had actually seen his urologist and he got referred over to us. So he says, the urologist says that my PSA is high and he wants me to do a biopsy. He sent me to your clinic to get a workup. So a PSA is prostate-specific antigen. It's a test to see if the levels of prostate enzyme are high, which may be a marker for prostate cancer. Funny thing about him is he went to the urologist because he was having some difficulty urinating. The urologist said, we're going to do the standard things, we're going to do a digital rectal exam, and then we're going to do a PSA. And so, being an engineer, he's like, okay, so what is this digital rectal exam thing that you're talking about? I hear digit, and I'm thinking finger, and I hear rectum, and I'm thinking it's not yours. So, clearly you want to stick something in my rectum, but that's not going to happen. It took a long conversation with Carl to figure out exactly what his phobia was with doing a digital rectal exam, and in fact, also doing the biopsy. So he's from the old school. He remembers all the things that his parents and his grandparents taught him about medical education. And so he has this knowledge of historical traumas that have happened to black men and black women throughout the country's history. So he very clearly remembers people experimenting and doing all kinds of weird things. He's like, you know what? I don't trust it. I've been to the doctors maybe twice in my life for a cold, been to the hospital once, and that was when I was born. I'm really not feeling doing all this stuff. So, part of the workup for a prostate biopsy is actually doing a enema. Now, he knows that his partner, who is the receptive partner, keeps himself clean, but he's hardly phobic of putting anything up his own rectum. So I asked him, I said, well, what does your partner do? How does he prepare? He's like, I don't know. He takes care of himself. That's his job. That's what he's supposed to do. He's the bottom. Wow. I mean, this is your partner of 18 years. And you're coming in for something to protect your health. So that was his issue. His two issues, actually. One is this historical trauma, but also this idea of shaming other people into to typical behaviors. I say all that to say that sometimes when we look at people, we think about them just as their general selves, but we don't look deep enough to see what are the problems or what are the issues that are happening underneath their lives that are producing this inability to seek out help or difficulty with help. So sometimes it's that people are survivors of sexual trauma. Sometimes they're victims of racism and homophobia, or they're suffering from some historical traumas. A couple of other barriers that we need to just address very quickly are insufficient knowledge of normal anatomy and normal function. So at the very beginning, I asked how many people knew every single thing that Ross had talked about. I couldn't even answer that. And those are all very normal things, very common things. In fact, most times when we do get a lecture, it may be something that looks like the picture on the left hand, on the right hand side there, where we see the entire digestive tract. And so we take it all in, but we don't really focus on one particular part. Or if we're older, we may get the one on the bottom, which talks about the prostate. And we think, okay, yeah, it's there. I gotta do it once every 10 years. Hopefully it doesn't happen. The other thing that we talked about is identifying trustworthy medical providers. And so it's not just finding somebody who's skilled. It's really finding somebody who will understand me and understand what's happening to me and what's happened in my life. And then we also need to make sure that we have easy ways and convenient times to connect with providers. So while it's great for me to go and see a provider in the middle of the day, that may not work for some people. People who are working night shift, people who are in schools, people who are doing multiple jobs. and sometimes the locations are prohibitive. Other barriers that we talked about, historical traumas, of medical experimentation of black bodies. If you have not read it, I highly recommend reading Medical Apartheid. It talks about every single atrocity that's happened since, I think, it's probably from slavery up until 2010, I think. But it's well documented. There are things in there that you just would not believe otherwise. And then lastly, considering the history of sexual trauma, and not just sexual trauma, but also what are the lingering effects of that? It's not as though the incident happens and you forget about it and you kind of move on with your life. All of that follows with you. And just as this little description here says, someone told him to keep quiet, but you'll be surprised to know how much he has to say. Just as I was surprised to know exactly how much the participants in my last study had to say. And in fact, there's a very strong correlation, well not correlation, there's an association with childhood sexual trauma and HIV positivity in black MSM. It's been documented in a number of studies, particularly amongst men who are HIV positive, I think it's about 1/3 of all who are HIV positive have had some history of childhood sexual abuse or trauma. There's stigma, there's tons of stigma, and we've seen a lot of this. So racism, homophobia, transphobia. I put this up here because, you know, we're talking about black men. And even though a person may identify as transgender, they still have all the same organs that a man has. They still have a prostate. We still have to worry about some of those things. In particular, as of the 27th of July of this year, 18 transgender women have been murdered in the US. That's the closest statistic I could find. 15 of the 18 were women of color. We've got shaming of HIV positivity. And then there's social stigma of both race and sexuality. So when I am working in my clinic, some of my other providers will actually work moonlighting in the ER, and they'll say every time a black man comes into the ER and he has a gunshot wound, we know he's a criminal. We just call the cops. This is 2015 and that's still happening. We've got shaming from within the community. So we talked a little bit about bottom shaming, femme shaming, heteronormativity, slut shaming, fat shaming, and again, HIV positivity. So I don't have a magic cure for how we build communities, how we get rid of all of the negative things that are out there. But I do have some recommendations. So the first one is that we continue to educate people about STIs, HIV, AIDS, PEP, PrEP, vaccines, and microbicide trials. And on top of all of that, general rectal and anal health, okay? Don't assume that everyone knows what's normal. And we really need to teach people how to evaluate their bodies, not just your partner, but yourself. And so I call this the man in the mirror. And so what I recommend that people do when I talk about anal health is I say, when's the last time you looked at your own anus? And they laugh at me and they say, what the heck do you mean? Like, I can't bend down that far. So I say, next time you go home, get a handheld mirror, lay on the bed, and put the mirror down there. We live in an age where people send sex messages, we send all kinds of pictures and all kinds of whatnot. Hey, you gotta do your anal wink. But really get to know your own body. Get to know everything that's your own. We need to teach MSM what anal sex is and what it isn't. And most people who learn about sex, at least MSM, are learning about it through pornography, which is laced with all kinds of racism, homophobia, all kinds of every type of ism that you can think of. So we really need to teach them what it is, what it could be, and teach them how to learn to like what they like. Lastly, on this slide, to teach them how to prepare for anal, of course. So we've heard a little bit about lubrication, we heard a little bit about douching or enemas, but also let's think about just regular diet. You know, are we eating foods that are actually promoting good evacuation? And then lastly, in terms of some policy and some medical personnel things, is to provide hours that are convenient to patient schedules and locations that are convenient. We need to identify trustworthy, healthcare practitioners who can provide culturally not sensitive, not competent, but sensible care. There's a great book called Cultural Sensibility that just came out. It's actually published, it's actually written by a nurse, which talks about how to not just be aware, but be actively engaged in promoting a culture of inclusiveness and understanding for each and every individual patient. How many people have heard of Blossom Brown? Anybody? Nobody's heard of her? So Blossom Brown is a transgender woman who is at Mississippi Women's College, I believe. And recently she was on the Ellen DeGeneres show. The reason she was on there is she's actually finishing up, I think she's finishing an associate's degree, and she's looking to go into nursing school. She was denied 6 times nursing school because she's transgender. 6 times. She went on the Ellen DeGeneres show. Caitlyn Jenner actually brought her on, and they've given her $20,000 towards her education. But the problem isn't funding it. The problem is actually finding the school. We have to be very inclusive about who we're training, and very mindful about how we're training for people. So again, identifying trustworthy healthcare providers sometimes mean finding people that represent the community and making sure they get a seat at the table. Also in this country, the admission rate for black men in medical schools has dropped dramatically. I believe women outnumber them 3-1, and that's women of color. But black males just are not going into medicine, so we have to find new ways and avenues of getting people in. And then lastly, just improve medical, nursing, and allied health training for sexual health. I can't tell you how many times I'm teaching in a class and people will say, oh, well, we would never see anybody who does that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you do. They're probably sitting right next to you. The problem is you haven't asked the question. Okay. And then lastly, use every opportunity to engage black men as an opportunity. To engage black men as an opportunity to talk about your life. And not just black men who have sex with men, but black men in general. You never know who's doing what. That's it.
So it's there are no, New York State has a recommendation, but no one else has a recommendation worldwide. And the thing about anal PAPs is it's not the PAP itself, it's what happens afterwards. So worst case scenario, someone has an anal PAP, PAP comes back with a lower high grade abnormality, and then the provider's thinking, what do I do now? So the knee-jerk reaction is to refer that person to an anal rectal surgeon. An anorectal surgeon won't be able to do high-resolution anoscopy, most likely, but what they will do is they'll put an anoscope in and they may see a wart. That will then lead them, because they're surgeons and all they do is cut, it will lead them to cut that wart out. So what's happened is you've had essentially what may or may not be a low-grade PAP, resulting in a procedure which is most likely unnecessary for a non-precancerous lesion. So I would say don't do anal PAP at all without the infrastructure to do high resolution anoscopy plus minimally invasive treatments of high grade disease. What I would strongly suggest you do is for any HIV positive man or woman to do a digital rectal examination on an annual basis. I would also suggest that if they experience any kind of anal symptom that lasts for longer than 2 weeks, someone takes a look. Anal symptoms come and go. We've probably had one, each of us probably had an anal symptom today, but it's probably gone now. They're incredibly common. Persistence is critical. So I have a 2-week rule. If you have anal symptoms for longer than 2 weeks, my patients give me a call.
Thank you. The doctor's office that I go to, they do it once a year once you're 40, if you have HIV. And I actually tested positive for HPV, and I was scared because I've been friends who have gotten cancer as a result of HPV, and so I found out that everybody had it. But, and he wanted to send me for a high res. It was just as Obamacare took over, and he wouldn't do it. The insurance company wouldn't cover high res. And I jumped through hoops, the only person who was even in the area that did it was in New York City.
Yeah, I also have a PhD in fighting medical insurance for this. So it's incredibly complicated. The short version is that the American Medical Association brought in a high-resolution endoscopy code, which was a T code, a temporary code, which we were forced to use. The insurance companies kicked everything back. We then had to fight each one individually. It's now an actual code, but depending on where you are, the insurance companies may still not cover it unless it's part of your state's Medicare. In Pittsburgh, that's not happening, so I simply bill for an anoscopy instead of a high-resolution anoscopy, which just means that I can see people can be seen.
But you still do a high-res and bill for an anoscopy.
Yeah, but your physician will take a hit.
Other questions?
Just that good.
I think the heat is too much.
Okay, if you guys don't have any additional questions,